From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, filling in for Terry Gross. After a 10-year run, Friends, the hit NBC sitcom, pulls the plug next week. No more hanging out with the gang in their roomy apartments or at the coffeehouse Central Perk, except in reruns. On today's Fresh Air, we bid farewell and feature an interview with actress Lisa Kudrow, who stars on the show as the ditzy Phoebe. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Musicology, the new recording by Prince. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Mean Girls, written by and co-starring Tina Fey of Saturday Night Live. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. A new Iraqi security corps led by one of Saddam Hussein's former Republican Guard generals has begun replacing U.S. Marines in Fallujah as part of an effort to end the siege of the city. NPR's Philip Reeves says, though, that the hastily assembled security force, which wears red berets and carries a Saddam-era Iraqi flag, has yet to be tested.
The strategy of the U.S. military appears to be to try to put Iraqis inside Fallujah in the hope that this will bring some degree of security within the city itself. What is less clear is how they will deal with the insurgents who remain within the city and who retain their arms.
NPR's Philip Reeves in Baghdad. Despite the pullback by U.S. Marines in Fallujah, there was more violence there today. A suicide car bomber killed two Marines and wounded six others. April closes out the deadliest month so far for American forces in Iraq. U.S. officials say a central figure in the insurgency in Fallujah is Jordanian militant Abu Mas'ad al-Zarqawi. In a new audio tape, a speaker claiming to be him says he and his supporters are planning major attacks in Jordan. NPR's Mary Louise Kelly has the story.
U.S. intelligence officials say they're looking at the new tape to try to determine if it's genuine. The CIA believes a similar tape released earlier this month was authentic. That Zarqawi message claimed responsibility for recent attacks in Iraq. U.S. officials believe Zarqawi has links to al-Qaeda, and they think he is in Iraq. On Friday, General John Abizaid, the U.S. Middle East commander, named Zarqawi as a key player in the current uprising in Fallujah.
For a long time, Zarqawi has used Fallujah as a base of operations. I can't tell you that he's there now, but I can tell you that he has personally been responsible for the killing of thousands of innocent Iraqi citizens.
In February, U.S. officials doubled the bounty for Zarqawi. There's now a $10 million reward for his killing or capture. Mary Louise Kelly, NPR News, Washington.
The top election official in California has banned touchscreen voting machines in four counties and may extend that ban to 10 other counties in the state. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more.
Secretary of State Kevin Shelley blamed the lack of security and reliability of computerized voting machines made by Diebold Incorporated. The decision follows the recommendation of a state panel, which cited a series of computer glitches, late software fixes, and poor service. Shelley's decision means that as many as 2 million voters will switch back to paper ballots read by optical scanners in November. Shelley also said that he may ban touchscreen voting machines in 10 other counties unless Diebold meets a score of conditions, including making alternative paper ballots available to voters. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, San Francisco.
Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 47 points to close at 10,225 in heavy trading, and the Nasdaq was off 38 at 1920. This is NPR News from Washington. Entertainer Michael Jackson stood solemnly in a courtroom in Santa Maria, California today and nodded his head when asked if he was pleading not guilty to 10 new felony counts against him. The charges include a conspiracy count involving alleged child abduction, false imprisonment, and extortion. Other counts involve alleged lewd acts on a child. Jackson was subdued in appearance and behavior compared to his last court appearance. He made a brief statement and blew kisses to a crowd of supporters as he left the courthouse. Former New Jersey Nets basketball star Jason Williams has been acquitted of the most serious charges against him in connection with the fatal shooting of a limo driver at Williams' mansion. From member station WBGO in Newark, Doug Doyle has the story.
Jurors acquitted the former NBA All-Star of aggravated manslaughter and aggravated assault, but could not agree on the charge of reckless manslaughter in the shooting of Kostas Christofi in 2002 at Williams' mansion. The jury did convict Williams of four lesser charges involving cover-up and evidence tampering. Prosecutors claim Williams recklessly handled a shotgun, which discharged, killing Christofi. Williams did not show any emotion in the Somerville courtroom when the verdict was read. He leaned back and kissed his wife. Prosecutors have not said whether they'll retry Williams on the reckless manslaughter charge. Legal analysts say Williams would probably receive a sentence of less than 5 years. For NPR News, I'm Doug Doyle in Newark.
A federal appeals court has upheld a judge's decision to strip retired Ohio auto worker John Demjanjuk of his U.S. citizenship. The court ruled the government had proven Demjanjuk was a Nazi death camp guard. The U.S. is now moving to have him deported. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, bringing together our employees throughout April in the Sodexo Serve-a-thon to help stop hunger in our communities. HelpStopHunger.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Next Thursday, NBC presents the finale of Friends, a 10-year-old series that ranks currently as the most popular sitcom on television. The network has stretched out its goodbyes for months, airing a long string of reruns so that the final episodes, one shown last night, the other next week, along with a retrospective special, would be saved for the all-important May ratings sweeps. But after a long period of teasing, the loose ends in Friends finally are starting to be tied. As in the scene last night when Jennifer Aniston's Rachel, who is leaving to take a job in Paris, gets a farewell gift from her good friend Phoebe, played by Lisa Kudrow.
Oh, Phoebes, I don't even know where to start.
Okay, well, before you do, I know we weren't supposed to get you going away presents, but I do have something for you.
Oh. What is it?
Well, it's a cotton swab with a bit of my saliva on it. So that if they perfect the cloning process while you're over there, you can use the DNA to create your own Phoebes.
I'm gonna throw this away. But thank you so much for the gesture.
Even if Rachel gets to Paris, she's not likely to stay there, any more than Carrie was destined to stay there in the finale of Sex and the City. It's no secret, and a no-brainer, that Rachel belongs with Ross, played by David Schwimmer. Ross has had a thing for Rachel ever since Friends started. In fact, thanks to flashback prom videos, viewers know his crush on Rachel began long, long ago. And even early in the series, when Ross was pining for Rachel, Phoebe said then they were destined to end up together.
I don't know. I don't get it. I mean, like 2 months ago, Rachel and I were like this close. Right now, what? I'm taking messages from guys she meets at the movies? I mean, this Casey should be taking out my messages, you know? Or Rachel and I should be together and we should get some kind of message service.
Hang in there. It's gonna happen.
Well, okay, now how do you know that?
Because she's your lobster.
Oh, she's going somewhere.
Come on, you guys. It's a known fact that lobsters fall in love and mate for life. And you know what? You can actually see old lobster couples walking around their tank, you know, holding claws. Like...
Before playing the ditzy yet outspoken Phoebe on Friends, Lisa Kudrow played an even more airheaded character, a waitress named Ursula, on another NBC sitcom, Mad About You. Not long after Friends began, it was established that Phoebe was Ursula's twin sister, and Kudrow has played that role several times on Friends, often sharing screen time with herself. On the larger screen, Kudrow has appeared in such films as The Opposite of Sex, as a very uptight and very smart woman, in Analyze This as Billy Crystal's understandably frustrated wife, in Romy and Michelle's high school reunion as a flashy valley girl slightly past her prime, and in Wonderland as the estranged wife of porn star Johnny Wadd. She's got lots of range and is a master at getting mileage out of an offhand or nonsensical remark. It's her 10-year stint as Phoebe, though, that has made her not only famous and wealthy, but has most strongly defined her public persona. Terry spoke with Lisa Kudrow last year and asked her about the side effects of being so strongly identified with such a popular TV show and role.
Now, Friends has been TV's most watched sitcom. How does that translate to how viewers respond to you? Because, you know, let's face it, lots of people watch it. it's really easy to be on TV now and feel like nobody's watching because there's so many stations. But I mean, that's certainly not true of Friends.
Oh, you know, in the beginning, people would meet me and just treat me like I was this like a performer at their kid's birthday party, sort of. You know what I mean? Just, oh, hey, and I know you'll want to do this, like dying to perform any opportunity I can. Hey, do the smelly kitty song, you know, every time I met someone. That was always funny to me, just thinking that I would love to. I can't wait to.
So what's a nice way of diplomatically telling them not a chance?
Yeah, just giggling. And so, no, I can't do that. And sometimes I'd even make, when they'd get really persistent, I'd make up something about, you know, I'm really not allowed because that's property of Warner Brothers and I'm not allowed. I'll look into it. You know what? Because people ask, this comes up a lot. I need to find out if I can do this or not. I don't know.
What was the character like at the very, very start when you were given the script, you were told about the character?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I liked about the character and what was written was they had this monologue in the pilot where she talks about how she left home when she was 14, her mother had killed herself, her stepfather was in prison, she lived in an abandoned car, all these things that were not even a little bit funny. And I just thought, wow, the only way this works is if this girl doesn't think any of these are a problem or, you know, they weren't traumatic to her. It's that, you know, other side of denial where it's everything's okay. It's all just okay. And if you sell it as okay, everybody will, you know, no one will feel sad about it. And that was interesting to me. That I loved that there was this person who had these horrible things and that's not the part of reality she's living in, you know, the horror of it.
I think the word probably most often used to describe her is ditzy.
Yeah, that came up a lot.
Does that word work for you?
Sure. Sure. Not so much now. I don't know why. Now I feel like there's just so many more times that she's being sarcastic and calling people on their stuff, making fun of them, whereas before she took everything at face value, and that's where some of the comedy came from, you know.
So she's gotten smarter in that sense.
Yeah. It makes sense to me, because since the beginning of the show, she's met her real mother, dealt with her father, done a lot of things.
How do you feel about this being the last season of Friends? Is that a good thing for you?
It's a mixed bag of emotions. You know, I love TV. I like a TV schedule a lot, and I love everybody I'm working with, and it's a good show. People like it. People watch it. That's all good. But it's fine that it's time to move on. I mean, honestly, I can't see doing this for another 10 years. You know, it has to end at some point. This is as good a time as any.
What are some of the things that you think you'll miss and some of the things you won't?
I'll miss, you know, those five actors and, you know, the executive producers I've become, you know, friendly with. I don't know that I'll miss, and I think I'll even miss Phoebe or being her, you know, like putting on that person, because that's what it feels like. I'd want to say putting on those clothes, but not literally, because I actually hate the clothes. But just putting on that skin of Phoebe, I'll miss that.
What do you hate about the clothes?
How unflattering they are, maybe number one. It's not my style at all. But and it's always tights, you know. I hate pulling up tights. It's very silly little things. But I don't know. I'll miss it. And in a way, I've missed the Phoebe that she started off being, to be honest. Anyway, I miss being so, you know, unreasonably optimistic and cheerful about absolutely everything. Because that was nice. That was a nice thing to do every day.
Is it kind of a relief from yourself to do that?
Yes, and a little of it seeps in, and I think it helps you cope with other things in your life better.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. That's why I actually have a hard time you know, defining anyone as stupid or, you know, ditzy or any of that, because it's an easier life, and it maybe isn't so stupid.
Is there anything in your life that you feel really connects to the lives of the characters on Friends? You know, like, did you ever have, like, friends walking in and out of your house all the time and a small group of people that knew everything about each other and that were lovers with each other and all that stuff?
No, not even in college. That was never part of my experience, to be honest, no.
Did you have lots of friends, or were you more on your own?
Not on my own. I've always had like a few good friends at a time, and then some acquaintances, you know. But no, I never really had that core group of men and women, you know, that were just friends. Because I actually never really believed that. I honestly don't know that men actually like to be friends with women. Maybe they do now. Maybe they're different. But, you know, back when I was in college, it seemed like men were really only friends with women if there was a chance of, you know, some sex.
Mm-hmm.
But so, no, it really wasn't ever my experience.
Do you know how the series is going to end?
No, I don't. But I just read something where Marta Kaufman, one of the creators, said she hopes everyone's going to be happy. The characters, where all these people that we've known for 10 years are going to be happy. So it won't be like everyone dies or, you know, one of those. It was a dream. No, I think everyone's going to be end up being happy.
You know, there's been like a whole industry of shows inspired by Friends. And, I mean, there are times, and it's been like this for years, when you put on the TV and you feel like every half hour there's a new group of people in their 20s or 30s sitting on a couch talking to each other and having affairs with each other.
Yeah.
Is that bizarre for you to watch?
In the beginning it was. Not bizarre, I just thought, wow. It was flattering. To be honest, it was flattering. And then a little sad, because I think TV does this all the time. I just read something the creator of Everyone Loves Raymond said, that they think that you're establishing a new formula for TV success. And you're not. You've just hit on something with, you know, the casting, and they click with the writer's sensibilities, and you've created people and lots of backstory for these people. So they feel fleshed out, and that's what it is. It's not just, oh, let's just put six, you know, young people in a room. See what happens.
Right. Now, you got the role of Phoebe on Friends after initially getting the role of Roz on the show Frasier. She's the producer of Frasier's radio show, the role now played by Perry Gilpin. And then you lost the role before the series actually started. What happened?
I'm still not sure. I'm still not sure what happened. I got fired before we shot the pilot. And I was really devastated, because I loved that part of Roz. I think that's a great part. And I was excited to do something that wasn't, you know, an idiot girl. Because I had been playing a lot of idiot girls in, you know, guest spots here and there. So, no, that really hurt. But Perry Gilpin is so great, and I knew her. We auditioned together. So I actually was happy that she was doing it.
Boy, how do you end up being happy that she's doing it when she took the role that you wanted? I mean, that's hard posture to maintain, I think.
Well, you know what? She knew all those producers. She had worked with them before when we were both auditioning for it. And I took the role she wanted, and that was really due her, to be honest.
Right.
You know, and it was nice to see it go back to her. And it was hard, but at the same time, I am a firm believer, and I had a lot of friends telling me, you know, the truth is, when something like this happens, it's because it wasn't meant to be, and it's saving you for something else that you're supposed to be doing.
Actress Lisa Kudrow, speaking last year with Terry Gross. We'll hear more in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with actress Lisa Kudrow, who plays the character Phoebe on Friends, the most popular sitcom on television. Friends will be wrapping up its 10-year run next Thursday.
If we can talk a little bit about your formative years. Your father was a neurologist, and he studied migraines. Did you ever have migraines?
Well, first, my father was an internist who then specialized in headache and did research in headache, important research. And my brother is a neurologist.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Who treats headache. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. Once in a while, nothing. I didn't have chronic headaches growing up, but I've experienced what a migraine is. Yeah.
No, I think I read that you had worked with your father or doing research on migraines. Do I have that right?
Yes, you have that right. When I was in college, I was a biology major, and my plan was to do research, not in the area of headache, but that was part of my plan. So after college, I worked with my father, helping him with research, and because I hadn't decided to be an actress yet, but it was creeping in at that point. And we actually did do a study. We looked at hemispheric dominance and was it related to the various headache types.
So did you consider medicine instead of acting?
Medicine was brief, in the beginning of college. But then I was really looking into doing, to studying evolutionary theory and more specifically areas of sociobiology and... the bottom line for me, I was really interested in the evolution of human psychology, seeing how environment and biology work together to inform the changes over time in our in our psychology.
So, how did acting win over that?
I had always, when I was little, I wanted to be an actress. It's so weird. I always wanted to be an actress, and I just put it on a shelf when I was in high school and college. Really squelched any of those desires. And whenever I'd come back from college on a break, I'd get these little like whispers or feelings about, I could do this. I think you could do this. It's like, yeah, but you can't, be an actual person that you'd respect and do this. So just put it away again and go back to school. Do something honorable. And when I moved back, it just overtook me. I don't know how else to say it. It just overtook me that I had to pursue acting. I could do it, and I wanted to do it.
Where did you start?
I started with John Lovitz, who I grew up with. That's my brother's best friend and like a brother to me. And I had seen him struggle, for a long time, and finally he was working. He got on Saturday Night Live, and I just finally let him know, I think I'm going to pursue this now. And he said, great, go to the Groundlings. So I've taken a lot of acting classes. I studied it in college. I've never learned more than I learned from the Groundlings and doing improvisation.
When he told you to go there, did they just, let you in?
No, absolutely not. No, they called up and said, when I called them, they said, what's your experience? And I said, well, in junior high, and so they said, yeah, here, we're going to refer you to this teacher who we work with a lot. And she was a godsend. Her name's Cynthia Seghetti. And she was the best thing that could have happened to me.
How come?
Because she didn't take no for an answer. And embarrassment was not an option. You just had to do it. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me. And, it's improvisation, and that could be scary. And some of the exercises look really silly, like lifting a disc, And I thought, that's so actory and embarrassing. I just can't. And the second class, I came in late, and she was just, talking everyone through it. She wasn't, warm and nurturing, although she was warm. But she was... come on, do it. You can do it. Stop laughing. We'll laugh. We'll tell you when it's funny. Just how to stay committed. She just forced you, sort of like with a gun to your head, on being louder and staying committed. And I'm watching these people lift a disc, and I'm so embarrassed for them, except for one guy who's doing it. And now I understand what being committed is. he was so committed that it wasn't embarrassing. He looked like he was lifting a disc. He wasn't overdoing it. He wasn't embarrassed. He wasn't commenting on it. He was just there acting like he's lifting a disc. And I understood what commitment was from that.
Is this a disc like a discus thrower?
There's nothing there. You're
right.
Pretending like, no, everyone's standing around in a circle and you're all working together to lift a disc.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. So it's a group exercise.
Yeah. But there's this one guy who's doing it, and he's not embarrassing to me. And I thought, all right, well, I got to be friends with that guy. That's for sure. And it was Conan O'Brien.
Oh.
Yeah. So we became friends, you know, from that class on. We were very close friends.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And so I just kind of stuck with him because I thought, okay, he's got a handle on this.
Actress Lisa Kudrow speaking with Terry Gross. Kudrow plays the character Phoebe on the sitcom Friends. There's more of their interview coming up, but now a scene from the fifth season of Friends. In this episode, called The One Where Phoebe Hates PBS, Joey, always scraping for acting jobs, enters the apartment with good news.
What you up to, Joe?
Well, you're doing this telethon thing on TV, and my agent got me a job as co-host.
Oh, that's great!
Yeah, a little good deed for PBS plus some TV exposure. Now, that's the kind of math Joey likes to do.
Ugh, PBS. What's wrong with PBS?
Oh, what's right with them?
Why don't you like PBS, Phoebs?
Okay, because right after my mom killed herself, I was just in this really bad place, you know, personally. So I just thought that it would make me feel better if I wrote to Sesame Street, because they were so nice when I was a little kid. No one ever wrote back.
Well, you know, a lot of those Muppets don't have thumbs.
All I got was a lousy keychain. And by that time, I was living in a box. I didn't have keys.
I'm sorry, Phoebs. I just wanted to do a good deed, like you did with the babies.
This isn't a good deed. You just want to get on TV. This is totally selfish.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. What about you having those babies for your brother? Talk about selfish.
What are you talking about?
Well, it was a really nice thing and all, but it made you feel really good, right?
Yeah, so?
Well, it made you feel good, so that makes it selfish. Look, there's no unselfish good deeds, sorry.
Yes, there are. There are totally good deeds that are selfless.
Well, may I ask for one example?
Yeah, it's, you know, there's... No, you may not.
A scene from the fifth season of Friends. We'll hear more of the interview with Lisa Kudrow in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The War on Choice, The Right-Wing Attack on Women's Rights and How to Fight Back by Gloria Felt, president of Planned Parenthood, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of our interview with actress Lisa Kudrow, and David Edelstein reviews the new film Mean Girls, written by and co-starring Tina Fey of Saturday Night Live. Also, Ken Tucker reviews Musicology, the new recording by Prince.
I see you pick me up from the crowd. Could it be the way I play guitar? Master of the soft, not too loud. One day maybe I will be a star. I see you pick me out like you want something. Shame on you, baby, can't you see this rain? What do you want me to do? Man, you got your man, so we got to do what's
This is Fresh Air. I'm David B. Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're returning to Terry's interview with Friends co-star Lisa Kudrow, recorded last year. Friends is completing its 10th and final season next week on NBC. When we left off, Kudrow was telling Terry how she found her way as an actress by identifying and exploring her comic side.
How come you saw yourself as a comic actor? How did you know that, at least at the beginning, it was going to be about comedy for you?
Because I thought, wow, you know, the people in comedy don't seem to take themselves as seriously. I could handle that. I think I could handle that, being around those people. A lot of it was just about who would I have to deal with if I'm going to do this career. And, you know, that was also a big deterrent for so many years before I decided to do it.
What were you afraid of in terms of the people?
Just,
pretentiousness?
Not so much a pretentiousness as too otherworldly, too, you know, because I feel like they're genuine in their erroneous beliefs. That's how I felt about it, you know.
What were the erroneous beliefs?
I don't know, a little too just anything goes. Because I was a really rigid kid and, you know, young adult. Really rigid. And I'm not saying I was right back then. But that's just how I felt. Like, you know, these people are idiots, and I don't want to be one of them, and I don't want to be associated with them. What I came to find out was that they're not idiots, and everybody, I more than anyone else, could use a little lightening up, you know?
Was one of your fears about actors was that sense of, like, elevating craft to an almost, like, religious level?
Yes, thank you. That's exactly... That was exactly what it was.
And what was your problem with that?
It didn't ring true to me at the time. It just felt like somebody trying... Yeah, I think you were right when you said pretentious. I don't know why I rejected it so quickly. That was unfair. Yeah, I don't know. It made me so angry at you. Maybe that was part of it. It just didn't ring true. It was something that I just always rejected. And, you know, I just lumped... I'm very black and white, and especially then. So I'd see an actor or an actress on a talk show and hate them, you know, and hate all their divorces and hate, you know, just how messed up they were and not seeing it. You know, behaving as if, and of course everyone would aspire to be me. You know, it really bothered me a lot.
You became really famous for your role on Friends. I want to ask you about a movie role that you had a few years ago in The Opposite of Sex. And it's such a great performance in this movie.
Thank you.
And it's a terrific film in general. And it's an interesting character for you because it's a comedic character. It's comedy, but your character is really smart. What she isn't is very kind of emotionally intelligent. She's got a lot of, like, emotional problems, but she's very perceptive and very smart and very articulate.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that character?
Yeah. Oh, I loved playing Lucia. You know, I recognized so much of myself in her because of that rigidity. You know, I was talking about in myself as a teenager and young adult, just I had all these rules and just sort of like an emotional disconnect, you know. And I don't know where and how Don Roos saw that in me, but, you know, he just offered me that role based on, I don't know what, Romy and Michelle, how? Friends? How?
Huh.
But somehow he just thought, yeah, you could be her. I don't, and I still am not sure why.
And, you know, she in the movie, she's in love with a guy who turns out to be gay and falls in love with her brother. And before the movie opens, her brother has died of AIDS. So she thinks maybe there's still a chance with this other guy, which of course there isn't because he really is gay. And then his sister, played by Christina Ricci, comes to town and she's really nuts. Anyway, so you think of yourself in the movie as the real, like, sane person, not realizing, like, what your own craziness is.
Right.
Do you have a favorite scene from the film?
In terms of the script, there's a lot of them I like. I really liked that moment where she's kind of fed up with Bill when they're in Palm Springs and talking about how her mother was so sad for her gay brother because how alone he must be, what a lonely life it is to be gay, which she's saying to her single daughter, who's more alone than he is.
Right.
I don't know, you know, but, oh, there's so much going on in that scene. It's just chock full of stuff.
Well, let's hear it. This is Lisa Kudrow and Martin Donovan in a scene from The Opposite of Sex.
I mean, I could like, dance around you naked. Vagina, vagina, vagina. Does that word do anything for you?
I don't think it does much for anyone, gay or straight. It's too clinical. It's like dentifrice for toothpaste.
God, so ironic. Do you know what my mom said when she found out Tom was gay? She said, it's such a lonely life. She said that to the single straight girl. Isn't that funny? I don't know, I don't get sex.
You should get out more.
I mean, I don't understand sex. I don't get it? Just, it seems like a lot of trouble for not much. Am I the only one that thinks this?
I don't think you're the tip of an iceberg, frankly.
No, I would rather have a back rub. You know, it lasts longer, and there's no fluids. You know, what's so great about that? It's like, hi, I'd like to blow my nose on your face. You know, you wouldn't like that, would you?
And after they do it, they never phone you.
That's a scene from The Opposite of Sex, with Martin Donovan and my guest, Lisa Kudrow. Now, you've become a mother since working on Friends, which means that, you know, part of the time you were pregnant. On the set. Was that difficult to deal with, either from, you know, the technical point of view or just, like, the physical aspect of it?
That was hard, technically and physically. In those days, you know, we were also shooting the show. We wouldn't be done till 1 or 2 in the morning sometimes. And I was just exhausted the whole 9 months. That was, you know, my pregnancy ailment was exhaustion and a little nausea. But that part was really hard. And also, no one seemed to understand that I really had to sit down a lot. You know, I felt like I was always trying to remind people, like, but I need a chair.
Right.
But it's hard for me to stay up this late. And sometimes feeling like if I'd ask, and it's asking a lot because there's 6 of us, can I shoot out my scenes and then I can go home? Sometimes yes, a lot of times no.
So it's hard to draw the line between taking care of yourself and feeling like you're acting spoiled and asking for special treatment.
Yeah, yeah. And so it was hard. It was really hard. And then also just how you look, and they didn't really play the Phoebe is pregnant thing. I was still hiding it or trying to hide it for a while. And, you know, in the beginning, you look like you've just gained a lot of weight.
Right.
So that was hard.
Do you think that the other women characters on Friends have been more sexualized than your character has been?
Absolutely. Sure.
And is that because yours is the more kind of comedic?
No, I think it's because I'm not as sexual as they are. I mean, I'm not as, I don't project that as much as they do.
So you think it's about you, the actress, not about the character?
Yeah, I really do. You know, there's no end to the amount of dating and, you know, sexual experiences that Phoebe refers to. So the opportunity was definitely there, but I'm not comfortable doing that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not any kind of, you know, like moral belief or I'm against it. It's not that at all. I'm personally not comfortable with that. So, you know, I don't like photo shoots. We did one early on where this one photographer who does stuff, and he did that famous shot of Jennifer on the cover of Rolling Stone where you see like a like a fuzzy, blurry, part of her tushy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's just about the sexiest thing I'd ever seen. And I thought it was beautiful. And so we were all doing a shoot, the three girls, and it was that same photographer. I think it was before, Jennifer's Rolling Stone cover, but he had us all doing different things that were kind of sexy and asked me to unbutton my top and keep unbuttoning it and opening it up just a little more. And as I was doing it, it felt awful to me. I didn't like the way it felt at all. I felt like taken advantage of.
Mm-hmm.
I just did, and I thought, what is this? All of a sudden, I'm like I don't know. It didn't feel right. I'm like a sex performer right now.
Right.
I have to be a sex performer for this photo shoot, and I wasn't comfortable with it.
So what'd you do? Did you say you're not comfortable and then button your shirt back up? Or did you say, well, they're asking me to do this, and I'll be a good sport even though I don't feel comfortable?
I was trying, it was more of, get comfortable with this, Lisa. Come on. Don't, stop that prejudice you have against everything. Maybe this is part of your old way of thinking, And I tried, and I unbuttoned it, and I opened it a little, and I tried, and, it just didn't feel comfortable. And the kind of face you have to make to look sexy. Opening your mouth a little and your eyes get really big and you purse your lips. That's like a comedy bit to me. And I've even done it as jokes in photo shoots or Polaroids. I always, as a joke, do this. To me, it's a crazy face. Uh-huh. And it looks okay. It doesn't look crazy.
That sexual pout.
Yeah, and it doesn't look crazy. It looks like what all these women look like when they look really sexy or doing these photographs. So now when I see those, I think, wow, the amount of contortion it took me to achieve that. I can't believe that's what you do without even thinking twice about it. Huh.
That's really funny. Do you know people who do that naturally, or do you think that whole style of sexual allure is almost always pure acting?
Oh, I think there are people who it's pretty natural for. Mm-hmm. I mean, my husband has a pout to him, and he's sexy, and that's natural, can't help it. Everyone in his family, they're all French, they just are sexy, and it's no act. But, yeah, so there are people like that. I know there are. But then there are others who, come on. Like, I know what you had to do to achieve that face and that arch, and it's just, like, so unnatural to me. Unless you're in, a bedroom.
Well, it's just been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lisa Kudrow, speaking to Terry Gross last year. She plays Phoebe on Friends, the NBC sitcom ending its 10-year run next week. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Musicology, the new album from Prince. This is Fresh Air. Prince was elected to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame late last year and gave a widely reported galvanizing performance of some of his greatest hits. He's followed that up with a current tour that surveys his career, and he's getting rave reviews for it. After spending a decade either releasing experimental music only on his website or refraining from public performance entirely, Prince is putting himself back into the marketplace with a new album, Musicology, distributed by a major label, Columbia. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review.
Heard about the party now, just east of Harlem. Dougie gonna be there, but you got to call him. Even the soldiers.
Prince starts off his new album with that song, Musicology, whose chorus is a call to, quote, kick the old school joint for the true funk soldiers. This is a lousy idea for a couple of reasons. Professing to be teaching the current generation of consumers that he's conducting a lesson in proper musicology makes Prince sound like the old fogey he's trying to avoid elsewhere by dropping a hip-hop name like Dr. Dre. And referring to us longtime fans as true funk soldiers. Well, I enjoyed the genre, but bridle at being dragooned into an army whose commander went AWOL on me more than 10 years ago. Much of this new music has some snap to it, with a heavier bottom of percussive emphasis. Clearly, for a guy who tends to play all the instruments on his records and used to showcase his guitar, for a guy who throws down the challenge, take your pick, turntable or a band, Prince has been listening to the turntables, and now thumps his drums harder. Musicology is heavily into Prince's nostalgia for himself, and he's a man at peace, happily married, a situation he sings about frequently here, and a Jehovah's Witness, a conversion that doesn't quite seem to have taken hold with convincing sincerity when he sideswipes a fellow witness, Michael Jackson, on the song I just played, Life at the Party, by boasting, "My voice is getting higher, and I ain't even had my nose done." The worst that can be said of the Prince of musicology is that he doesn't sound like he has much fire in his belly. He's no longer the defiant funk rocker I saw get pelted with garbage and racist taunts when he opened for the Rolling Stones in L.A. in 1980. I guess we've all come a long way. That's Prince's Cinnamon Girl, not Neil Young's. If the current Prince sometimes sounds like a henpecked hubby, an entire blues song begging his missus not to make him sleep on the couch, he still has the goods when it comes to going into the studio and laboriously constructing, track by track, pieces of music that sound as though they were bursts of spontaneous joy.
If I was a man in your make you happy, I treat you right. I buy you flowers every single day. Give you power, I do whatever you say.
Hey, rumor that your man, he said he'd do you wrong. And you're so vain, you think that you're the one behind the song. Sure, you know he got plenty lyrics, yeah, up his sleeve. And after he got what he wanted, just go up and leave. Sunday chaplain on the roof right after his game. He liked the Lakers, but the Sixers on when he came. If he's with another now, you best believe the party's cracking. You get played, girl, you better get your Mac on. And you earn to others.
Musicology is, as we used to say, a mixed bag, full of spunk and wit one moment, weighed down with self-importance and irrelevance at others. It sounds like the greatest hits tour coming to your town is a gas, but then energetically played nostalgia can always seem like a lot of fun, for the first few numbers anyway. Then you remember that the reason you loved rock music in the first place was for its shock of the new.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly.
Don't touch. Music-ology.
Johnson.
Coming up, David Edelstein reviews Mean Girls. This is Fresh Air. Mean Girls is a new high school movie from a girl's point of view. It's written by Tina Fey from Saturday Night Live. In Mean Girls, she plays a math teacher. Fey based Mean Girls on the nonfiction bestseller Queen Bees and Wannabes, a how-to survival guide for teenage girls. The film stars Lindsay Lohan from Freaky Friday. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Teen movies, the good ones, have a kind of buoyancy. They bob along on the newest slang, on this year's cute teen models, on up-to-the-minute music, actually covers of old songs by faddish new bands. That's appropriate, since they revolve around putting old-fashioned morality plays into hip new packages that play like dispatches from the youth front lines. The latest, and one of the jolliest teen packages in years, is Mean Girls, a good-natured hybrid of pop sociology and satire, written by the 33-year-old head writer of Saturday Night Live, Tina Fey. She began with the nonfiction bestseller Queen Bees and Wannabes by Rosalind Wiseman. The book is subtitled Helping Your Daughter Survive Cliques, Gossip, Boyfriends, and Other Realities of Adolescence. And it's a scattershot mixture of classifications, the queen bee, the floater, the pleaser, and graphs, maps, tables, and lots of anecdotes about girls getting trashed by other girls. That's followed by tips on how to empower your daughter. I hate that word, but nothing else fits. To transcend her peer-designated role and navigate successfully through that scary place that Wiseman calls girl world. The good thing about this how-to manual as the basis for a screenplay is that it grounds Fey's work in observed human behavior, rather than, like most Saturday Night Live-affiliated movies, a limited performer's limitless ego. Fey is not even the star. She plays a frazzled but good-natured teacher who turns into a Rosalind Wiseman-like counselor. The protagonist is 16-year-old Katie, played by Lindsay Lohan from last year's Freaky Friday, a newcomer to American high school after years of being taught by her research zoologist parents in Africa. That means Katie can look at teen rituals from an anthropological or really zoological perspective. Those kids around the fountain at the local mall, they're like the beasts mating by the waterhole. The subtle one-upmanship and sabotage, it would happen on the veldt with claws and fangs. The early part of Mean Girls is like a mixture of Heathers and Goodfellas, complete with journalistic narration. The nonconforming outcast Janice Ian, not the singer-songwriter, but maybe an allusion to her, lays out the various cliques and draws a map of the caste-segregated cafeteria. And it's at lunch that Katie meets the popular and exclusive Plastics, two blondes and a brunette, led by the so-called fount of all evil, Regina George.
Why don't I know you?
I'm new. I just moved here from Africa.
What?
I used to be homeschooled.
Wait, so you've actually never been to a real school before?
Shut up.
Shut up!
I didn't say anything.
Homeschooled. That's really interesting.
Thanks.
But you're, like, really pretty.
Thank you.
So you agree?
What?
You think you're really pretty.
Oh, I don't know.
So if you're from Africa, why are you white?
Oh, my God, Karen, you can't just ask people why they're white.
Could you give us some privacy for, like, 1 second?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, you should just know that we don't do this a lot, so this is like a really huge deal. We want to invite you to have lunch with us every day for the rest of the week.
Oh, it's okay.
Coolness. So we'll see you tomorrow.
On Wednesdays, we wear pink.
Actually, I found these plastics surprisingly likable compared to the ones I knew in junior high and high school, who were less clicky but more mean. Or maybe they just seemed more mean because I was so horribly vulnerable to them. It's in these scenes that Faye's comic gifts mesh beautifully with Wiseman's firsthand research, and the director, Freaky Friday's Mark Waters, dotes on the long-limbed actresses who play the plastics, Rachel McAdams as the Tigress Regina, Amanda Seyfried as the apotheosis of all dumb blonde jokes, and the dark one, Lacey Chabert, as the low girl on the totem pole, the one who labors almost hysterically to maintain her position. Lindsay Lohan has a natural red-headed Irish-American prettiness that makes a nice contrast to these wiggly Barbie dolls who magnetize Katie even as she tries to bring them down. Will Katie become the new queen bee, or will she recover her healthy zoological perspective? Not a lot of suspense there, and Mean Girls is more of a premise than a plot. It runs out of steam toward the end when Faye's teacher gathers the girls together in the gym and tries to get them to recognize the patterns of envy and aggression that rule their lives. Yet even at its squarest, that mixture of parody and therapy feels sort of hip. Maybe it's that Faye, who has triumphed in the male-dominated world of TV comedy, wants to lampoon her female subjects as a way of making them more aware and more connected. What is it like today to grow up in a world in which the social caste system of American high school culture is openly acknowledged instead of mindlessly acted out? I would hope it would be empowering.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Aveda, an earth-conscious beauty company committed to preserving natural resources and finding more sustainable ways of doing business. Information available at aveda.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the subterranean world of terrorist financing, from the diamond traffickers of West Africa to the network of Arab money changers. We talk with The Washington Post's Douglas Farah. He became the subject of death threats while researching his new book, Blood from Stones. Join us for the next Fresh Air.